You know, we're not going to get through a whole lot in Genesis today because I'm going to do a little bit of an introduction to the book, and then we'll talk a little bit about in the beginning. You're absolutely right, and our focus will be kind of in the beginning, the first couple of verses, and then I anticipate that from there we'll go a lot further into kind of the 6 days of creation, the seventh day of rest, and then I've had I had inquiries too about whether or not, and I would ask you guys a question, because usually when I do a study, it's kind of, you know, what does the Spirit have for us, and I try to gauge not only you guys but what I feel like the direction that we need to go in, and sometimes I get caught between this idea of how deep to go and how maybe to stay or keep ourselves from going way too deep, you know, because we could get, you know, we're not a theology class. We don't necessarily need to go so deep into the woods that it's like confusing and we have to put on our scholarly hats to be able to do that. So I'm going to try and strike a balance between that, which is not always easy to do. So I would really appreciate feedback from you guys as to, you know, hey, that's just tell me, hey, that's a little bit too deep, or it's not deep enough, we want to go a little bit deeper. One of the things that I've done in the past is when talking about creation and so forth, there are a lot of things that we could discuss about creation and evolution and things of that nature that aren't necessarily the book of Genesis proper, but that are things culturally and society and philosophically that we could discuss as well. And I have done lessons on, you know, evolution and creation and things of that nature, and we can go in that direction. We could put the pause button on the text and say, okay, let's just do a lesson on, you know, the difference, you know, creation versus evolution and some of the different things there. When I did that, and I don't remember, Renee, if you were in the class at that time, but when I did do that a few years back, you know, took a couple of hours out of what we were doing at the time to do that, and actually did a lot of personal study and research. I have like 4 or 5 books I poured through, literally. So I have some of that. We could come back, could circle back and do some of that. You know, it was written by Moses. So last week when we were talking about the law, we said that Moses actually wrote the first 5 books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, also referred to as the Torah. And last week we said the Torah means law. Pentateuch just means 5 scrolls, or sometimes people would say 5 vessels, right? And so the Pentateuch was written by Moses, generally accepted to be written by Moses. In fact, Jesus in the New Testament talked about the law of Moses, and so he, in doing so, in talking about the law of Moses or the law given to us by Moses, Jesus kind of confirms that the first 5 books of the Old Testament were written by Moses. And so if Jesus is confirming it, historical church fathers also confirm it, then we're going to go ahead and stick with that, and we're going to say Moses was the author of Genesis. When it was written is up for a huge debate, right? We'll say that we don't necessarily know when Genesis was written, but we know that the time period Genesis covers is from the beginning, right? We don't know exactly when the beginning would be. We'll talk about that a little bit. So a couple of things as we go into this study to talk about is, what is the purpose of the book of Genesis? Because we can talk about evolution, we can talk about creation and the whole creation process by God, but the question that we might have is, what was the purpose of the book of Genesis? Why is Moses writing that, and what's his desire? What does he want to reveal to us in writing the book of Genesis? Any thoughts on that? What do you think? And I'm not necessarily saying there's a right and wrong answer here. There are probably several answers. What do you think Moses' motivation is in writing the book of Genesis? Any ideas?
I always think of it as the constitution of the Jewish people. It gives you, I think the covenant is center, and then it puts some context around.
I would attribute kind of all the 5 books of the law of the Torah as exactly that, kind of the constitution or the covenant with the people. There's the covenant with Adam, and there's the Mosaic covenant. Abraham is in here that we'll be able to see as we go through the book of Genesis.
It's the selection of the Jewish people from, you know, separating them from the pagan.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly what we were talking about last week is the separation part of that. Yeah, so part of this is that selecting his people. That would be part of it.
If you're thinking of covering, is there any part that we're going to talk about why the Jewish people are the chosen one?
I had not thought about, you know, what made them special. I would think that the only thing, because, you know, when we look at ourselves as well, it's mostly God's will. And God's will takes precedent, and his desire takes precedent over anything that's any kind of admirable attribute that we have, right? So he doesn't necessarily look at a people and say, those people are better people than those other people, in my opinion, in terms of they look a certain way or they have a certain attitude. I think that if we talk about the origins of his covenant with his people, it starts with Abraham, right? And when we get to conversations about Abraham, we will talk a little bit more about that, because the Bible says that Abraham had faith, and because of that faith, it was given to him. Righteousness was applied to that and given to him because of that, and that would be the admirable attribute, if you will, that Abraham had going into it, and part of the reason that his progeny, if you will, was blessed by God. And that's interesting when you get into that, because and don't want to go too far down the Abraham road, but it's interesting if we talk about Abraham's background and his family, and how did Abraham become this guy who had faith and what have you. So we will probably go in that direction a little bit. What more?
Well, at the time, you know, I mean, Moses, we don't, whenever he wrote it, we might assume that he wasn't certain of the future arrival of Christ, but the book sets up, it begins the lineage that leads to, you know, the emergence of the Messiah.
Absolutely. Yeah, so when we joke, and I think partially jokingly said that Genesis starts in the beginning, and that is exactly what you just said. The book Genesis actually means, or the word Genesis means, beginnings. And so
the beginning of what? Right?
Yeah, so how many of us enjoy watching a movie from the very middle of the movie, right? None of us like to come into the middle of a movie and start watching the movie. Well, if we turned anywhere into the New Testament or even the Old Testament without starting in Genesis, we would be starting in the middle of the story. We'd be starting somewhere after the story began. So Genesis absolutely tells us how things started and provides us with the framework for the rest of the entire Bible, right? It sets the stage primarily for Jesus Christ, the entire redemption story. So what does God reveal in creation about himself? Those things are important in the book of Genesis to be able to figure out, what does he reveal about himself? What does he reveal about his nature in the book of Genesis? And so we see that.
I mean, it's hard to interrupt. But, no, you know, so I think in the Gospels, you know, a lot of Jesus's interaction with the broader population is in the context of David and David versus Jesus. And so I don't think you really understand who David is without going back to Joseph. And then you can't understand Joseph without going, you know, I kind of feel it's like back. I'm peeling the onion all the way to Abraham or to Noah.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely part of this, is kind of knowing the story. You know, all of us have gone into movies in the middle of the story and didn't know what was going on. My worst little quick 30-second thing on that is my brothers were not always on the necessarily the straight and narrow. Nothing really bad, so don't get me wrong, as they were growing up, but they were kind of a little wild at times. They would probably admit that. I remember when I was very, very young, you know, we had the Star Wars craze. The Force Awakens is out now, right? Well, the first Star Wars came out, I don't know when it came out, sometime in the 70s, okay? Yeah. So I was very young. I was like, you know, 10 years old or so. My brothers went around to the back of the theater with me in tow, because they were babysitting at that time, and one of their buddies inside the theater opened the exit door And we went in the back of the theater. Now, back in the 70s, you know, ha, 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 yeah. That's funny. Like, here now, like, that kind of thing is crazy. But okay. Even then, it was probably not right. I didn't know what was happening. I was naive. I just followed my brothers. We went into the theater. We sat down, and I looked up on the screen, and there are these I didn't know what they were at the time, these TIE fighters, right, on the screen, zooming around in space. I'd never seen anything like this before, and I was blown away by it. I had no idea what I was watching, right? And so the entire time, just no clue as to what's going on, because we didn't get in the movie at the very beginning. Right. Started in the middle of the movie, right? And I'm seeing this crazy thing that I'd never seen before. We don't want to do that when it comes to the Bible. We want to start at the beginning. So, again, Genesis from the beginning. The most important...
And it's funny you say that, because Genesis is... It's an introduction to God in the middle of the movie. Because he's saying, hang on, I'm the one that did this. Mm-hmm. I am the beginning. I am the great I am. This is the story of how your world started. This is the scrolling screen at the beginning of the film.
Right. Yeah.
And I think the introduction, the whole portion of the from the very first sentence to the very end of it is the revelation of Jesus Christ. But at this point right now, he's saying, look at the world around you. This is the physical evidence. This is the external evidence that I created this world. I'm going to show you how I did it. Is Moses telling the story? When he did, whenever, I don't know. But this mm-hmm. is the introduction. So
one question: the whenever he did it is back to whether Moses lived centuries or whether he lived.
So 1,500 years ago, and it's amazing when we talk. And I'll talk about it a little bit this morning about like the age of the Earth kind of thing. And we might, if we do more on the evolution side, we might get deeper into that. But so. Oh, and he left. So in the beginning, I want to read the first two verses in Genesis, and then we'll talk more about the beginning. So Genesis 1, I'm reading out of the ESV. It says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters." I'm going to stop right there. I know that there's a lot more. We know that there's from there. We know that there's 6 days of creation. And on the seventh day, what did God do? He rested, which provides a pattern for us as well. So look at the very front end of this book. It says, in the beginning. And it says, in the beginning, which we already know, start of time. We don't know when the beginning is, right? There's going to be, we'll talk a little bit about that. But in the beginning, and the next word is God created. So one of the very first things out of the chute that we've got to realize is that Moses says, in the beginning, God created. What's really interesting about this is that Moses doesn't go on to write a lengthy explanation about God. Moses starts the book of the Bible, this book of the Bible, Genesis, with an assumption that God is. And there's assumption that God is even before the beginning. There's an assumption that God exists in and of himself. And so we know that God existed before anything. In the beginning, God created. That means God created from the very start of time what's called ex nihilo, or out of nothing. God created, so from nothing, God created. So a couple of different things. Interesting that Moses says from the very beginning that God created. There's no, he doesn't go into a string of apologetics about God and the existence of God, but God himself is assumed to be in existence. And so that word again, the beginning, it means, Genesis means the beginning. And so these are the first words. It's a classic introduction. In the beginning, God created. A classic introduction. The entire book of Genesis records at least up to 9 different beginnings. The first one is the beginning of the earth, the beginning of the earth, and man's habitation of the earth. The beginning of the earth and man's habitation of the earth. The second is the beginning of the human race. We're going to see in chapter 3, it's the beginning of human sin. The beginning of human sin. In chapter 4, the beginning of redemptive revelation. We talked about the plan that God had. You know, God wasn't surprised by what happened with Adam and Eve. It didn't take him off guard. He didn't have to go to plan B, right? These things, God knew these things were going to happen. So the redemptive revelation of God. And the fifth one, the beginning of the human family in the core families in chapter 4, you'll see that. The beginning of godless civilization godless civilization, the beginning of nations in chapter 10, the beginning of human languages in chapter 11, and then the beginning of the Hebrew race and the covenant people. You'll see the beginning of the covenant people. Again, God doesn't, or the Bible here doesn't set out to prove God's existence. Moses, that's not his purpose. His purpose is that he simply assumes God exists. So, look at, someone look up really quickly, Romans chapter 1, verse 20. Romans chapter 1, verse 20.
Verse 20?
Mm-hmm.
All right. It says here, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they are not without excuse. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they, unbelievers, are without excuse.
So you see, at the very beginning, his attributes, everything that he did has been laid out before us. And the book of Romans tells us, and especially there's a whole apologetic at the very beginning of Romans that for, as Renee pointed out, for unbelievers to say, look at the creation, look at the world that God created. There's no excuse. We get to see his attributes in creation from the very beginning. Another one is Colossians chapter 1, verse 16. And actually going to back it, I was just going to read 16, but I'm going to back it up. It's Colossians chapter 1, verse 15 and 16. One of the things that we're going to find out is that that all three persons of the Trinity are present in creation. All three persons of the Trinity are present in creation. In the beginning, God. So that's God the Father. And we just read Romans 1:20. The preeminence of Christ is in view in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. Talking about Christ, it says, he is the image of the invisible God, Christ. The image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. Verse 16 says, then for by him, this is by Christ, by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. So Jesus Christ, the New Testament gives us the idea that Jesus Christ was present in creation. Do you remember when we were reading 1 John? And what does 1 John have to say?
In the beginning was the Word. Mm-hmm.
This is that which was from the beginning in reference to Christ. 1 John, that which was from the beginning. That's okay. John, in the beginning was the Word. And that would be in the book of John. It would reference the Word in the beginning. And so Jesus Christ is in view here. Along with the Father, we know that Jesus Christ was present, not only present in creation, but active in creation. The verse from Colossians lets us know that Jesus Christ was active in creation. So the Gospel of John says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. So when we read in Genesis, in the beginning God created, the Gospel of John tells us that he was in the beginning with God. In chapter 1, verse 2, he was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So when we look at creation, we see God the Father, and we know from the New Testament that Jesus Christ is also present there. And we know that from 1 John, and we know that from John chapter 1, really verse 1 through 5 in John chapter 1, that the Son, the Word, Jesus Christ, was present in creation. So we know when was in the beginning, the who. So far, it's God the Father and also the Son, that we get that from the New Testament. Look at the third piece of this, back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. It says, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. The Spirit of God then is present in that second part of verse 2, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And so you get this image, how does the Spirit's presence take form? You know, when we look at the Hebrew word there, it's ruach, R-U-A-C-H, and that word means wind or breath. And so you see the active Holy Spirit that's hovering over the face of the waters, the face of the deep sometimes, and you see this imagery. You see this imagery that starts to develop that the Holy Spirit is there. And so the power of the Holy Spirit takes a formless presence and it's hovering upon it to give form and purpose to God's will. It gives form and purpose to God's will, and it's very symbolic of the Holy Spirit's work in our lives. The Holy Spirit giving a purpose to us. And in creation, it's hovering over the face of the deep and giving form and purpose to that. The other word that's in here from verse 1 is the word created, right? We've already said that he created. Well, what is that Hebrew word created? In the Hebrew, the word bara, B-A-R-A, means created, and it's used exclusively of God. It means to create something out of nothing. We said that before, ex nihilo. There was nothing that existed before God created it, right? He created something from nothing. Now, that flies in the face of people who have different ideas about creation and what creation was all about. Somehow a single cell existed, you know, somehow.
So that's also saying that the earth is already here, right?
Which part?
That idea that
somehow a single cell. Somehow that cell existed.
That means Earth was already.
They would go back to the Big Bang, and they would say that energy existed, that different forces came together to create the Big Bang. They would not attribute that necessarily to God.
It has been explained that satisfactorily is how you trace it all back to that first.
Where did that come from, right?
Transaction or that first event.
Something had to exist, right, before. And so I'll bring a little bit of this, you know, especially when we get into the days of creation, because there's controversy about, you know, the number of days of creation. Not controversy, I would say, differences of opinion. Maybe someone would say controversy, but...
Go back to that word, opinions. The bara, you said?
Bara. It means, it's actually used in the Bible exclusively of the creative powers of God. Yes. Exclusively of God, and it means to create something. B-A-R-A. It's a Hebrew word. B-A-R-A, and it means created. It's used exclusively of God. No, and it's used to mean out of nothing. He created from nothing. And so obviously, modern students have created many different theories about how creation took place, and we can talk probably a little more even next week as we get into the days. I'll just briefly mention some of them. There's the gap theory. There's progressive creation. There's theistic evolution. There's atheistic evolution. All of these are different theories about the number of days and how things were created. Some people believe that a god, right, was the catalyst that began the evolutionary process, right? That would be different than what we read in the book of Genesis. Christians don't believe, typically, some people would say, well, I'm still a Christian, I believe this, that God created the process of evolution in the sense, and I would say in the macro evolution sense, that God created all of these things and then stood back and watched the evolutionary process take place over billions of years. That's theistic evolution. That's not what the Christian believes. Right? So some people think, well, yeah, I can believe in God. And theistic evolution basically says that they have a God who's maybe not personal. The creation account in Genesis is a very personal story. It introduces us to God and his purpose. his purpose for creating, right? His will in creating. Theistic evolution says he started the process of evolution and then stepped back and just watched that random, seemingly,
chaos
process happen. Do you see that? And so it takes kind of the relative part and the relationship part.
This is the root of my original qualm, existential qualm.
I knew I was going to open that up.
At the heart of it.
That's the heart of your...
Yeah, I mean, not that I believe that he created, stood back and watched. I believe that.
Yep.
I believe that the hands are shaped in there, but what is the...
Well, I was going to say, so what I heard you say, the emphasis is not on the technical as much as it is the randomness.
About evolution?
Yes.
Yeah.
The theistic evolution. We can't call ourselves Christians and believe in randomness, that God was like,
whatever happens, happens.
Whatever happens,
I'm
going to
step back and say, so let me clarify a little bit. So let me clarify a little bit. So there are, we believe as Christians, and part of this was maybe going to be for a separate lesson, but that's okay. We'll go into this because we usually go down rabbit trails like this. So that's my fault. So part of this, part of the problem, because the next one is atheistic evolution. Atheistic evolution is very much kind of just nature is just happening the way nature happens.
So there is no God. God's dead.
So, and there is no God a part of that, but nature's just happening. And it has to take billions of years for anything cohesive to happen, right? Because everything else is just chaos.
Law of big numbers.
If it's not billions and billions and billions of years, we don't get, you know, kind of... Someone might win the Powerball today, right? But the odds of any one person buying a ticket and winning Powerball are astronomical, right? The odds of the evolutionary process creating something cohesive and coherent in a short time period is so astronomical, it's no one would believe it.
Right.
Scientists wouldn't believe it, right? But so they say... There's so many billions of years that eventually
the iteration
order comes out of chaos, right?
Yep.
So on the theistic side, what they'll give you is they'll say, no, there is a God who's a part of this. And so when we get to those problems in evolution where the evolutionary process can't create the next thing, God steps in and does it. Right, so theistic evolution says he starts it on the roll, and then when there's a problem, let's say if you're a computer person and you're creating code and your process is working properly, but you get to a glitch. Whenever there's a glitch in the evolutionary process, theistic evolution allows for the possibility to God to step back into the evolutionary process and create order out of chaos.
But that's... against the concept that God had a predestined plan all throughout from the beginning.
Again, it
in
takes.
In the beginning, He knew.
Okay.
It takes what we believe about the Bible and the relationship that God has with His creation and His people out of the picture, and it makes it very much kind of a sterile, if you will, God, very much an unpersonal God. Now that's just, and let me say this one thing, because that's just kind of when we talk about theories, if you will, of creation, philosophies of creation. I would offer to you guys that we don't believe, number one, a mythology, number one, and number two, we don't have to check our brains at the door to be able to believe the Bible. I believe that because we stand on the side of truth, that the things that we are, the things that science even reveals to us, have logical explanations in the Bible, and that the things that the Bible reveals to us can be explained. So, I don't think that we have to stretch our minds to believe the Bible, because I believe that we follow and we stand on the side of truth. A lot of people think that we have to contort the Bible to fit science. I think at the end of the day, and when I say the end of the day, the end of the ages, when all true science, you know, is completely and perfectly revealed, you'll find that science has to adapt to what God had already provided us, and what we already, what God has already revealed to us.
And also, and some of the revelations in the book of Genesis, the way they're laid out per se, we might not understand exactly what they all.
Yeah, that was the one thing.
Mean at a given time.
I mean, it's an interesting thing about the Bible. Probably two of, if not the most, but two of the most difficult books in the Bible to understand and interpret.
Well, caps.
Genesis and Revelation. How did things start? How are things going to end? Right?
For that very reason.
Almost everybody would tell you that those two, you know, there are some things in the Old Testament too that are kind of, wow, how do you understand that? But Genesis and Revelation are the two most difficult things, and part of that, I think, is
rationalizer too. Yeah.
Yeah, is the finite nature of our understanding.
Because in the in-between, we have to rely on God on both ends of our lives.
Mm-hmm. But I would say, too, and we've had people even here say, hey, you know, it's just a blind faith.
No.
I don't believe at all that it's a blind faith. I believe that it's a very rational faith. And we're gonna talk more about that as well.
It's a rational faith, and then the revelation comes along.
I even think, for example, that the argument about evolution versus creation, you can take the conversations about God out of the picture, and you can have a conversation about evolution or an intelligent designer, and you don't have to talk about the Christian God or what have you, but you can go to evolution and say there are some fatal flaws in the theory of evolution. So I believe that wholeheartedly. I think there are things, and I mentioned briefly the irreducible complexity of a cell as an example. You can look that up. We can probably talk about
What's
that.
What's the Ben Stein movie, Expelled?
Yeah, the Ben Stein movie, Expelled, is a
tremendous.
There's a video of him and Richard Dawkins where he interviews a very famous atheist about his idea of creation. And in the interview, and I'm sure that it's sliced and edited and what have you, but Richard Dawkins says, as he's asked the question, how did all of the matter that needed to exist for the Big Bang, how did that happen?
What was the origin of that?
Richard Dawkins says it could have been planted by aliens. So Richard Dawkins is more willing to believe in the possibility that alien beings visited our universe and planted the seeds of creation. He's more willing to believe that than he is to believe in God.
But, I mean, that's aliens in a different universe.
But, you know, to me, the fundamental paradox is that, you know, you're guilty of, you know, being trained in science and engineering is you go to the Sunday school class and you start with Jesus and you work back and you got the ages of all the people and you get 6,000 years and and then you have rocks that you know, science will say
carbon
older
dating
than that, and you'll say that the oldest human remains were not found in Israel but they're found somewhere else. So, you know, I guess I have a view that, I believe in creation, but I also use the term, I believe this is the constitution of the Jewish people. I actually have a hard time believing
6 days
that there's an I don't care about the 6 days. To me, the time is the time is not all that important.
Relative.
And to me, it's not, you know, the you know, we start to get a lot more precise about numbers and dates as we get further into the book. The book's written by Moses, who wasn't the first person, so he's, you know, he's backdating and filling in everything before him, and you know, I believe that the Jewish people were chosen, but I also, you know, there's archaeological evidence that says there were people in Africa before there were people in Israel.
Yeah, and part of the argument would be kind of where was the Garden of Eden, for example? What was the origin? What was the location? Of the garden, the specific location, we know the Tigris and Euphrates, and we know things of that
nature. But there's
nature.
Also, you know, there's evidence that says, okay, there's something we recognize as humans in East Africa, but then everybody walked, and you know, what squares the sort of scientific view with theological view is that everybody walked through the Tigris and Euphrates.
The Middle East,
and so I see this is, you know, this is a, you know, Moses didn't have an archaeology degree, and that this is where, you know, that this. So I take the creation story as you know, it's God, he's an active agent.
Mm-hmm.
But I can believe that, you know, Moses lived here, even if there's human remains here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me that doesn't cause a big theological disconnect.
Yeah, so we bring up quite a few things. There are different, when we get into the days, there are different theories about the days. And I know you said you didn't care about the days, but the days are what dictate the age of the earth, right? So one of the questions is, you know, how old is the earth, right? There are rabbi scholars, and there are young earth, you know, the whole young earth Christians that believe that the earth is nowhere more than about 10,000 years old. So if you look at, if you were to draw this out on a chart, if you were to draw this out on a chart and you said, okay, 10,000 years old, right? Whereas science believes that the earth is anywhere from 8 to 18 billion years old. So that's not even here to the sea. I mean, if you're looking at a bar chart, right, or, a, you know, it's not even, how many thousands are in a million, how many millions are in a billion, right?
Somebody just told me yesterday, so like a million seconds is like 33 days or something like that.
33 days.
But then like a billion seconds is like 33 years.
Right.
Right?
So
it's like, I mean,
sorry.
It's
exponentially just...
So we're not even, we're not even in the same universe when it comes to how old is the Earth. So there are a few different explanations to that in terms of, you know, from the fossil record and from different things, you know, because if the Earth is much older than the fossils, you know, it could have very well been an Adam and Eve in Mesopotamia, and we could still find fossils in Africa later on. We just haven't, you know, we don't have the fossils from Adam and Eve in Mesopotamia earlier. So the age of the Earth kind of comes into play there. And the question is, how did God create? Did he create in 6 days? Did he create? Can you go back and look at the genealogies? The book of Genesis tells you how old Adam is, right? So you know that he lived about 900 plus years. And so that's how the rabbis have gone back and added up the genealogies, and that's
well,
how they've tried to determine.
What's the etymology of the word day? Because, you know, a day to Moses is the time it took the earth to revolve around its, rotate on its axis once.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if there's no earth, if there's no sun, then what is a day?
Yeah, so the question is, that's why I go back to the 6 days, right? Because it does come back to timing, whether you think it's a shorter, a younger earth, or an older earth.
Our time, our known time, or it's God's time?
It comes back to what you believe in Genesis chapter 1, 6 literal days or not. So there are several theories. One is the 6 literal days. He did it in 6 days. It was very fast, and it was done.
24 hours?
24-hour days.
Right.
Another theory is called the day-age theory. Are you guys familiar? Have you heard the day-age theory? They believe, and that's your question, one day, the day-age theories believe that one day could mean multiple years. It could be millions or even billions of years, and one day in Genesis 1 is an age. And so they try to use... word studies to be able to do that. That word is nam, and the question is, what does that word mean? And I am prepared to talk about that specific word day, to be able to say, what does that word mean? In Genesis 1, it was evening and it was morning the first day. It's evening and it was morning the second day. There's an appearance in chapter 1 that it's a 24-hour day. So there are other theories. Let me finish the thought, because then I think you'll have more questions, and I might answer some of the questions with the full thought.
This is just the intro.
There are other theories about Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. One of them I mentioned is called the gap theory. It believes that Genesis chapter 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, period. That was a statement that said, in the beginning he created the heaven and the earth. And there was a creation that took place over an indefinite period of time. Some people believe even billions of years could have happened in verse 1. And that in verse 2, it starts off with a very specific account of the creation of human beings and the preparation of the world for human beings. Genesis chapter, or verse 2 and so forth, is about the ordering of creation. And you're going to see when we talk about it in depth, the days of creation, that there are two triplets in the 6 days. And what you're seeing is you're seeing God order his creation. So the gap theory says there's a gap there in time from verse 1 to verse 2. Now, some people say, no, I don't want to go there because that's too much of a leap to try and conform the Bible to science and things of that nature. So that's one other theory. I know I keep cutting you off.
Don't worry.
Do you want to go ahead and jump in? Okay, so then the next
one. It all
one.
Wraps up into one.
So another. So that's the gap theory. There's another theory that's very similar to the gap theory, and it's called historical creationism. It's a fairly new idea that some people are posing. It's very similar to the gap theory that says Genesis chapter 1 was in the beginning, billions of years, dinosaurs even, the whole nine yards are happening in verse 1. I said chapter, but in verse 1. In verse 2 and on is specifically about the preparation of the world for Adam and Eve and God's covenant people. And it says that there may even be, after Adam and Eve, there's other things that are happening, but the world had been created. There are part of the gap theory and the historical creation theory say that verse 2 says the earth was without form and void. They will do word studies that turn was into became without form and void. So the idea that there was a creation that eventually degraded and then was either recreated or reordered by God starting in verse 2. If that were the case, that would explain many things, you know, the carbon dating of older fossils that appear to be billions of years old and things of that nature, geological structures and so forth. The other argument from kind of the young earth perspective is a very interesting argument. And I can tell you that I personally have been all over the spectrum on this. I have been kind of very gap theory curious because I have also looked at evolution and things of that nature. So, and I could tell you that I am starting to lean more towards a younger earth for this reason. When God created in Genesis, and when he created, if you look at the 6 days, when he created plants and animals, and he created Adam and Eve, the old adage is, what came first, the chicken or the egg? The answer is the chicken.
Correct.
God didn't create an egg and then watch it
evolve.
No, not watch it evolve, but watch it hatch, right? Watch it hatch into a little chick and then grow into a full-grown bird. When he created Adam and Eve, he created them as mature adults.
Correct.
Okay? So there is a sense or an idea that God, in his creative power and his supernatural creative power, created the world with the appearance of age. And it makes sense if you look at the Genesis record in the first chapter that he didn't create Adam as a baby who had to grow up over years and finally become mature. He created out of his word that we get in John chapter 1, the word created a mature individual,
correct,
a fully grown. So logically speaking, you could look at the entire earth and you could look at the entire universe and you could say he created everything with the appearance of age. Now some people would say, no, wait a minute, that's deceptive of God. How can you call God deceptive? He's the creator of all things, the origin and bringer into light of all things. So for me, that's a very compelling argument. Everything in Genesis chapter 1 was created. When we get into the details of the days, you'll see plants are fully created, right? I have a pear tree in my backyard. I know that pear tree cannot produce fruit unless there is a bee and unless there's another pear tree that they can cross-pollinate with. But when you look at the order of creation, you're going to see plants that are fully grown. They didn't come from seed and have to germinate and have to be pollinated by insects that maybe weren't even in existence yet. They were fully grown, fully producing, right? He spoke into it. And here's another example of that. When you look at, remember I just talked about John chapter 1. I'm getting on my soapbox now.
Cool.
John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word. We looked at Colossians, we looked at Romans, and we said at the very beginning that all three persons of the Trinity were present in creation, including Jesus Christ. We don't often think about Jesus Christ in an Old Testament context, but Jesus Christ, if he is God, was always God, right? He didn't just become God when he was born in the manger, right? He was always in existence. Okay, so here's the thing. He was in existence as a human in the manger, in the flesh. Right. So, but here's the thing. In the New Testament, when you see miracles of God, or miracles of Jesus Christ, how do those miracles occur? When he sees a blind man, he says, open your eyes and you can see. The blind man doesn't go through a process, although you could say, well, that blind man saw trees, you know, people as trees walking, and then eventually he could see. But it happens instantaneous. The lame, he says, get up, grab your things, and walk. They get up and they walk.
He doesn't say rehabilitate.
Jesus's miracles, and if you believe in the supernatural, right? We're a people that believe the Bible. By definition, we believe in the supernatural. Not everything that we believe has to have a natural explanation, because we believe that God is supernatural. That means he's above nature and above the natural order of things. And the reason he's above that is not because we just want to put him there because it's convenient for us, right? We put him there because we believe he created everything. So if he created everything, then he's above things. He's supernatural. When Jesus Christ does miracles in the New Testament, they're instantaneous. The other example, in the book of, I believe it's Luke, you only see certain miracles happen. They don't give a bevy of everything that Jesus did, but he does it on purpose because he shows the dominion of Jesus Christ over certain things. He shows the dominion of Jesus Christ over death when he raises people from the dead. He raises more than just Lazarus from the dead. He shows dominion over death. He shows dominion over disease. He shows dominion over the spiritual world when he heals demoniacs and people that are that way. And he shows dominion over nature. Remember, there's one scene shows, and wine, making the water into wine, things of that nature. But the other scene that I'm talking about was they're going across the Sea of Galilee. Christ is asleep on the boat in the middle of the storm. So imagine that kind of just as an everyday example for us. He's sleeping on the boat in the middle of the storm. That's supreme confidence, isn't it? You ever been on a small boat on a big lake when the winds were whipping and the waves were starting to crash? I have, and I thought I was going to die, right? The last thing I would be doing is sleeping, but Jesus is sleeping because he's supremely confident, right? The disciples go and wake him up, and they say, what do they tell him? We're all going to die, right? And you're sleeping. I mean, come on, give me a break. He wakes up. He basically says, peace be still. And what happens? Instantaneously. It didn't have to slow down, and it went from a massive thunderstorm to a trickle to a, instantaneously, the waters are still. And so much so, remember, these people are the disciples, meaning many of them fishermen. They know what it's like to be on the sea, right? They know that storms don't just disappear like this. So they marvel at him and go, who is this person that even the winds and the seas obey him? Do you see that? It's instantaneous. So if we think that Jesus Christ was in creation, why wouldn't his words also be instantaneous? Mm-hmm. Why would they have to take billions of years to happen, right? I'm not saying that it couldn't. What I'm saying is I can hold out.
It's a credible theory for the created with age, I think, is interesting.
Yes,
it's,
thank you.
What I could say is this, and that's why I would start off from the very beginning. My very first question was, what's the purpose of Genesis? And I think someone hit it on the head. You might have hit it on the head. The purpose is to know, number one, that God existed before time. Mm-hmm. Number two, that he created all things out of nothing. And number three, he created for his will. We haven't talked about that yet, but he created for his will and his own good pleasure. And the fourth part of that is that he created people to exist in a loving relationship with him. To glorify him and to love him forever. That's the chief end of man. It's why we were created. All of those things. That last one is he created for relationship. Evolution and some of the other theories take the relationship out of God's nature.
It destroys the relationship.
It takes it out of his nature. So all of those reasons, you know, that's the primary purpose of Genesis, is to get those reasons. The timing is secondary. Whether it was a billion years or 6 days, I believe is secondary. Now, some people would say that's a hill to die on. It's got to be 6 literal 24-hour days or else you're not a believer. I'm not in that camp. I hold out a little bit of the possibility that there could be a gap theory there. A little bit of a possibility that there could be maybe a day-age theory. But I personally lean towards the kind of a plain view. If you just looked at it without having to go, wow, what is this talking about? If my 5-year-old read the Genesis story, the 5-year-old would come away saying, and I said, how long did it take God to create? The 5-year-old would say, it took him 6 days. because that's what the text says, right? So I hold out the possibility that there could be different times and different lengths of times in Genesis. I lean towards the younger time frame, but I'm not saying that that's a hill I'm willing to die on and a necessary for everybody to be able to believe that he created out of nothing, he created for his own will and for his own purpose, and he created people to have a loving relationship with him.
I think you answered one of the ones, which was, you're talking about days. Days comes under the concept of the earth revolving
24 hours,
24 hours in the whole concept, so mm-hmm. it's earth-centric in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking about the young earth, where God said, that's the way I wanted and that's the way I intended originally, all right, that answers that question, you believe that.
Yep.
But then the other one is a much bigger one around, with all these theories and all these interpretations, mm-hmm. all these possibilities, us as Christians, and more specifically, as part of the Houston First Baptist Church, what is the guidance around, or there's latitude, as long as you believe in these key precepts,
and those five things that I just told you just are the key precepts to believe in.
The core and the essence. Yes. Of because, I mean, remember, I got started in this is I want to show my sign of obedience to God by, and the church here to take this step of baptism.
That's right? That's right.
But these things were in my head to be a consequent person, at least the way I am.
Yep.
I don't want to jump in and say,
I'm all
blindly,
in.
I'm all in because
I agree.
I want to be consequent, right?
Yeah.
So what is that framework of guidance that I need to...
So I believe it's those five things that I talked about are the core about what Genesis is, the purpose of Genesis,
well,
right?
The way you laid it out, I'm in. And then if there's room for interpretation...
So I would say that our church, that First Baptist, if you were to be baptized there, that there is no requirement for you to have to believe a six literal days of the book of Genesis for you to be able to be baptized because you believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God...
Yep.
That you're a sinner saved by grace.
Yep.
And those are the key tenets of what... And if you go to First Baptist, you'll find it. And I've been a Sunday school teacher at First Baptist for a long time.
Yep.
Right? And Ben Pritchett and different people there that are ministers there, that I don't believe lockstep, even with our pastor, on every single theological...
Mm-hmm. And that's free will.
...idea, right? The church allows us that flexibility. There's a word that I've used before, a Latin word called adiaphora. Mm-hmm. Adiaphora means indifferent things. There are many things within the church that are considered indifferent things. And in those indifferent things, among the believers, we should have charity with one another. We should allow for slight differences. They even create denominational differences, and maybe they get more contentious than they need to be.
Right.
But there are indifferent things. If you believe the main things about Christ, that's all you need to be baptized. And don't let the indifferent things mm-hmm. keep you from making that step.
Yeah, there's
exactly.
As Beth Moore says, there's a spine of faith and then there's a ribcage.
Yeah.
And the spine of faith that you believe that Christ died on the cross for your sins.
That's what you need.
That's the spine. That's the other stuff is the ribcage that holds everything together, but the spine, the actual basis, that's the key thing. I encourage you to maintain the faith of a child. He set a very good example with his son, his child reading the book of the Bible and going, "Hey, how long did it take God to create the earth? 6 days." And that's the faith we need to go into our belief in our salvation mode. As simple as that. That's all God asks. It's just a simple... I'd say simple faith.
Yeah, because I said earlier, it's not a blind... I mean, I think we have a very rational
It's a very innocent... It's a very innocent acceptance that God is the creator. And he's saying, I did this. And by the way, because I have a dominion over everything, I can save you.
I think that was very helpful, the way you linked the Genesis, the origins, to, for example, Jesus' miracles and... All right.
The nature of the supernatural.
Nature of some of those. I had never heard that way. Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. It really is.
My own view is that Abraham appears in around chapter 11, chapter 12.
Chapter 11.
I just come with books chapters 1 through 10 with a certain humility. I mean, I think if you look at the New Testament,
absolutely.
I mean, the New Testament is a modern document. Mm-hmm. You know, Jesus Christ is a historical figure. His existence is documented in secular texts.
Yep.
You know, the Roman Empire was the governing body. You know, there are historical figures, and so we know that there's a lot of confidence that, you know, through textual criticism, whatever, that the New Testament emerged from eyewitness accounts.
Mm-hmm.
If we say that Moses wrote this, and he put himself, you know, he introduces himself, he's not even coming to, he's in Exodus. So we don't have eyewitness. You know, mm-hmm. Moses was not an eyewitness, so he's inheriting, and, you know, he's got revealed word from God. He's got an oral tradition.
Right, that's the key. This is a revealed word from God,
and
Holy Spirit.
But you know, to me, you just have to have a certain humility with books chapters 1 through 11.
I would agree with that.
12 on
becomes more of a historical narrative after that.
So Victor's point, I mean, every story, right, has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
And usually the middle somewhere. Can be the exact middle, it can be the off center. That's where the conflict is. That's what sets the whole first half and the back half of the story is, here's the crux of the story. What happened? What is the conflict? And that's the deal breaker that you're talking about. The crux of the story is Jesus, I'm a sinner, and so forth. And all that other stuff is important and it sets everything up, but that's the deal breaker. Exactly.
So for me, when we become Christians, the primary purpose for us is to believe those core tenets, right? But I never want to stop there and say, "Hey, just have a blind faith." That's why I personally study
it,
right? Because there is something to be said about trying to study and to understand the nature of God and who He is. And then also, when we were in the book of Jude, the book of Jude said, hey, be ready to contend for the faith, right? I want to be able to be not like the West Wing lady in the video from last week, who sits in the chair and gets berated by a fictional president who, like you said, I think you're the one that said it, is a messiah figure for certain political...
For certain
political people. I don't want to be that person who sits there and can't speak up, right? So while I understand the tenets and that's good enough for me, part of my engagement in the world and to be able to be salt and light, which the New Testament says that we should be, is to be able to be equipped to engage with our culture and with society. In order to be able to do that, you know, intellectually speaking, I have to learn and study a little bit more, and some things I'll get right and other things I won't. And the New Testament even talks about the mysteries of God. There are, if someone said it recently to me, that thank God that I don't fully understand God. Because imagine if we could fully understand God and put Him in a box, He wouldn't be God.
Yeah, you'd be him.
I would be Him, and He wouldn't be God, right?
Yeah.
So thank God that I don't fully understand God. So I do think what you said about, you know, the taking a little bit of I don't know how you phrased it, the first 10
humility,
verses with humility. You know, there's one more theory on that, and just briefly say the framework theory that takes the whole first 10 and says it's not trying to lay out the process of creation at all, that it's only providing context and framework for how creation happened, and that creation was happened through God. And it's more of a kind of non-literal, literary, and more, they almost look at it more like a poetry, almost even a mythology, and these would be Christians that say, I have a literary framework for the New Testament, for the first few books the book of Genesis. I said the New Testament, the first few books of Genesis, and that's called the framework theory. But so there are a lot of different things. Again, a lot of it, I think, is adiaphoric in different things. We need to know the main...
Stay with the plot,
right? But there are rational. But there are rational answers. When we die and go to heaven, we'll know. When we die and go to heaven, we'll know fully as He's known us, and hopefully things, all these kind of mysteries will be revealed to us. But there are some rational. It's not completely insane to believe in a young earth.
It's
right.
not.
I agree. Really and that's insane. Something I learned today. So I take that away. I think that, I think though, the part of, when you say the framework theory, what resonates with me there is there's a lot that we know, forget about the AGR, just a lot we know about the process of human life that is not enumerated in the gospel. It wasn't deemed to be
important. It wasn't
deemed to be important. You know, the word oxygen doesn't appear in the first 10 books. You know, the word water does appear, but, ovulation, you know, conception, you know, there are certain, you know, chemical and biological photosynthesis. I mean, you know, things that are essential to human life.
That wasn't the purpose of
God's design, but they're not enumerated in the...
That wasn't the purpose of the book.
But it's important. So it's important, I think, again, back to this maybe rationalization, but to me it's all about setting the stage for a covenant, which is a spiritual act. It's not a... I don't think it's meant necessarily to be a science text. I think it's meant to be...
It's not at all.
It's meant to be a theologic and human history. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I totally agree. It's not meant to be a science text. But I also would say, to add a little bit to that, is that because everything here is true, no truth exists.
Other than.
Well, he's right.
So
and it doesn't talk about
exists, and it's not
that's true.
I meant to explain absolutely.
I guess what I'm saying is that at the end of the day, things that maybe even appear to be contradictory to different things, I think the Bible will ultimately prove out to be true, ultimately true. And so it does provide us with things, but it's not meant, you're right, I mean, absolutely, it's not meant to be a science text.
Be all,
not meant, we're probably right, we need to wrap it up. Yeah, we need to wrap it up.